Today on Maine Calling, reaction to the verdict in the Trump hush money trial. Guilty on all 34 counts, a New York jury yesterday made history by convicting a former U.S. president of felonies, a first. But what does this mean for Donald Trump and for the nation? What comes next? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we try to put the Trump verdict into context with political scientists who are professors here in Maine. We discuss the potential impact of this unprecedented trial and verdict, if there is one at all, and what does the response say about the American electorate? We also want to hear your reaction. Did you expect this verdict? Will it change your vote? The Trump verdict on Maine Calling. That's just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. By Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling, and I'm Jennifer Rooks. Yesterday, former President Donald Trump became the first former president in U.S. history to be found guilty of felony crimes. Today, we'll discuss what this may mean for the upcoming election and what may be next in what has been referred to as the hush money trial. My guests for this hour are Mark Brewer, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, and Pavel Binchak, shareholder at Bernstein Scher, who has a background in criminal law in the military and federal and state courts. We invite you to join the conversation. What are your questions about what happened yesterday and what the implications might be? What's your reaction? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. For those of you tuning in to hear our scheduled program on the benefits of walking, we will reschedule that show soon. I want to thank all three of you so much for coming on the program today with very short notice. I'll start with you, Ron Schmidt, and just a general reaction when the verdict came down, all 34 counts guilty. What was your reaction?
I was actually watching with my kid, who is 11, and we were both, I think, sort of maybe geared to see a mixed result. So as the guilties came, just sort of kept pouring in, we were both kind of amazed. You know, it was funny. I was actually on television talking about the election when Trump won in 2016, and I kept thinking about my kid then. So it was wild to actually watch the guilties coming in yesterday, sitting side by side with her.
Yeah, and Mark Brewer, you too. Were you surprised?
I wasn't necessarily surprised at the verdict, although I guess I expected more of a mixed verdict. I was really surprised at how quickly it came in. Right, I thought this was going to take days, if not maybe even weeks, and the fact that it came in less than 10 hours was pretty surprising. I had to scramble to get myself in front of something that wasn't just my phone, so I could watch it come in. And I actually ended up being able to watch it with two of my children as well. So, it was kind of a family event at our house.
And Mark, how old are your kids, if you don't mind my asking?
The two that I was able to watch it with, one is 17 and one is 14. So they were, and one of them actually does a pretty good Donald Trump impression. Interestingly enough.
Yeah, so what if they're, yeah, I remember watching the moon landing. This is something your kids are going to remember. Pavel, as an attorney, you've heard both Mark and Ron say that they were a bit surprised that it wasn't at least a mixed verdict. I think a lot of people feel that way. I think a lot of people were surprised by the speed. A lot of people made some assumptions that, oh, if it's this quick, it means A or B or C. Tell me about your reaction.
So one of the key things about our legal system and how trials work is that juries get the critical role of weighing a witness's credibility. And what this verdict tells me is that they believe these witnesses. They believe that regardless of the past and what was brought up on defense and cross-examination, that these witnesses were in fact telling the truth, and that there were that these jurors had some real concerns generally about the conduct that the prosecutors raised. Love it, hate it, what however you feel about this verdict, we're living through a time where our constitutional conventions and our constitutional norms are going to be challenged. Things are going, this case is going to put some things in really sharp relief. And over the next several months, over the next year, our appellate courts are going to have to make decisions that are going to shape legal history for the United States. It's a fascinating time to live through, although I certainly wish we didn't have to.
You're talking about the appellate courts, so and I'm going to go back to you on this, Pavel, because this is so interesting. All of the commentators I've heard so far on NPR and other media outlets have said this will surely be appealed, as though it's a given. It isn't the way the court system works that a defendant can ask for an appeal, but it's not necessarily granted. Doesn't there have to be grounds for an appeal?
No, there does not. So everybody has a fundamental right to appeal a jury verdict, and your attorney has the right to file all of the things that they think were wrong or improper or procedurally incorrect with the underlying trial. And in every state and in every federal jurisdiction, an appellate court will review it. Now, that does not mean that an appeal has to be granted. The appellate court does not have to agree with the defendant. But they do, I think every defendant gets that right to present their issues. And that's one of the things that helps guarantee fairness in our system.
So just the act of filing an appeal might delay any sentencing or any or the sentencing that is given being carried out.
So the courts have a lot of discretion in that. Certainly, the former president can move, and I expect that he will, to have the execution of the sentence stayed until an appeal is resolved. Given that this is such an unusual case, it's certainly possible that such a motion to be could be granted. Typically, they're not. You have to understand that just about every criminal verdict is appealed in some form or other. Certainly, every criminal verdict, or fe I'm sorry, felony verdict, just because the stakes are so high. And when you're talking about somebody's liberty and you have this chance to argue to get it back, everybody's going to take that chance. So you have so many appeals flooding the system, and people will typically go and serve their sentences until their appeal is resolved. Sometimes they will have served their entire sentence before their appeal is resolved. So it's I don't expect an appeal to push back the sentencing date. In terms of the execution of the sentence, it's such an unusual case with it being a former president and the profile of the defendant that the judge is going to have a lot more considerations than he would in a typical matter.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I'm going to turn to the politics of this a little bit. Ron, we all saw the reaction, right? One side is saying this is a sham. It was politically motivated. This is, all sorts of names for what kind of court it was, the word clown being used. The other political side relieved that the court has finally confirmed what they believed all along, that Donald Trump is deceitful and dishonest. Those are sort of the two big narratives emerging, but there are some other layers, aren't there? Other ways through, lenses through which to see this verdict politically.
Yes, indeed. One of the strategies that the former president likes to use is an attack on the institutions of American government to sort of make the argument that the way the system itself is organized is corrupted, and that therefore that creates a different kind of playing field. And the primary lens that I came away from this was that we were watching a jury trial. We're watching a case where, in this way in which basic norms of American democracy are at play within the judiciary branch itself, 12 ordinary New Yorkers had an opportunity to look at evidence, some of which involved witness accounts, but a lot of which had to do with documentary evidence, and to weigh in themselves on the guilt or innocence of the former president. So I think that another important way to look at what happened is that it was a victory not so much for one political ideology or another, but for the functioning of this institution of American democracy.
Hmm. Mark Brewer, one of the questions that many political scientists are asking, many operatives is asking, is what kind of difference will this make in the election, if any? Do you believe it will make a difference?
I think it'll make a difference. Exactly what that difference will be and how big or not big that difference is very much up in the air at this point. One of the things that I suspected would happen, we're now getting information, did in fact happen, that the former president has broken records for the amount of money raised in a 24-hour period, right? We're just getting, according to his campaign at least, that they raised almost $35 million between the announcement of the verdict and midnight last night, which shatters any kind of record over that kind of time period. And I suspect that will continue, right? That Trump will raise lots of money off of this. He's done that in the past, whether it's injunctions, mugshots, or indictments, rather, not injunctions. He raises lots of money off that. So that I suspected would happen. It did. In terms of what kind of impact this is going to have at the ballot box in November, there's a lot of different scenarios, but it's way too early to say which of those is more likely. There's too much ground to be covered between now and November.
Mm, and some of the possibilities are that it might mobilize his base. Another possibility is that those swing voters may decide not to vote for him. I mean, give me some more. These are just a couple that are the obvious ones that we've heard discussed.
Well, I think the swing voter one is the really the one that we need to pay the most attention to, right? I don't know that his base can get any more solid or can get any more motivated to go turn out and vote for him. So, yes, this could have an impact on the base in terms of how they might behave, but I don't think it changes in any way, shape, or form how they're going to vote or the likelihood of their voting. And the same thing is on the side of the same thing on the side of the coin of those people who despise Donald Trump and think that he's the worst threat to American democracy ever, right? They can't get any more motivated to vote against Trump. It's that small group in the middle who are either unsure of what they're going to do in November, whether that be vote choice or even vote at all, or maybe a very small group of people who are leaning Trump, leaning Biden, but haven't committed yet. What might this verdict do for them? And that's really, I think, what both campaigns are going to be taking aim at, are those small groups.
And I would just add to that, I think Mark's totally right. I would just add to that that elections can be decided by incredibly small numbers. You know, we're really looking at a small handful of swing states where margins of victory can be a hair's breadth. And so these are small numbers of people, but they could wind up being incredibly decisive.
Mm. And let me ask you, and I'll turn to you, Ron Schmidt. We've heard a lot about the young vote. You all both work with young people and how a lot of young people, the polls are showing, are disillusioned with Joe Biden. Does this make a difference to them? Do they say, wow, I'm disillusioned with Joe Biden, but boy, I don't like Donald Trump even more after this verdict? Or do you think it's negligible? Ron?
It's hard to say at this point. It is a long time until the election. The sense I get from students, at least on my campus, is that there is a certain amount of disillusionment with the Biden presidency and a fair amount of cynicism with Donald Trump and his career. And so I doubt that the outcome of this election will change their minds very much. But it might be part of a story that helps to change their level of commitment to actually participating in the election. We'll just have to see. It's too early to say.
Pavel, I want to repeat to you something I've heard recently from a couple friends. And I want you to explain to me why this will or will not happen. People have said to me, I don't think this matters because we all know this will end up in the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court will find in favor of Donald Trump. What do you say to someone who says that?
So I would say that it's an incredibly long journey to get to the Supreme Court. Any criminal conviction in the United States can theoretically end up at the Supreme Court. The way to get there, though, is that you first have to navigate all of your state's appellate courts, all of which are going to have various barriers to entry and gateways. And at a certain point, the courts get some discretion over which cases they choose to take. And nowhere is that more true than the Supreme Court. So as you can imagine, every criminal defendant in the United States would love to take their case all the way to the Supreme Court. And if we allowed that to happen, we would not have a functioning court. So what ends up happening is that you have to apply for what's called certiorari. It means you have to have a unique enough legal issue. Typically, it's something that is going to be to resolve a dispute between the federal circuits or something of momentous value to American jurisprudence to raise before the court in order to be granted that certiorari. Just feeling that a case is unfair isn't going to get you there. So the president, or the former president, is going to have some significant hurdles to get there. And even if he does get to the Supreme Court, he still fundamentally has to prove that there was legal error in the underlying trial. And that is challenging for defendants. So what I would say to those folks is that nothing is impossible, but it's a long road. And that's not something that's going to be resolved today or tomorrow or next week or next month or before this election. There's a lot of courts that have to weigh in before Donald Trump even has the opportunity to be heard at the Supreme Court on this case.
An interesting point I heard this morning on the BBC, Pavel, is that though Donald Trump constitutionally, of course, may continue to run as president, there's nothing that says anything about a felon, whether or not he or she can run for president. He now cannot vote for himself.
Yes. So in many states, individuals with felony convictions are not allowed to register to vote. They're not qualified voters. And so he may not be able to cast that traditional ballot in his own name on November 5th.
Mm. We are talking, of course, about reaction to the verdict yesterday in the trial that's been referred to as the Donald Trump hush money trial, the historic trial that finds a former president for the first time guilty of felonies. Our guests are political scientists and lawyers. What are your questions? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are discussing yesterday's verdict in the Trump hush money proceedings, the 34 counts of guilty. We were going to talk about the benefits of walking on today's program. We will reschedule that program. We will, if you are tuning in to listen to that, you will be able to listen to that later this summer. My guest today, Mark Brewer, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, and Pavel Binchek, shareholder at Bernstein Scher with a background in criminal law in the military and federal and state courts. Joining us now, Kevin Miller, Maine Public State House reporter. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. And yesterday evening, after this verdict was announced, right away we heard reaction from three members of Maine's congressional delegation. Then a little bit later, Senator Susan Collins. Tell us about the different responses.
Yeah, sure. So I would say the responses from our congressional delegation largely followed the partisan reactions that we've seen elsewhere. The delegation's more left-leaning members. They praised the jury and expressed confidence in the process. Representative Shelley Pingree, who's a Democrat and represents the kind of left-leaning first congressional district, she said the process was really fair and that the results reaffirmed that no one was above the law. Jared Golden, who's also Democrat but represents the more conservative second district, he said that Trump had his day in court and that he respected the jury's decision. But then I thought it was interesting, he acknowledged the political reality that regardless of this verdict, Trump is still the likely nominee and that he trusts Maine voters. And then he had this prediction, I guess not much of a prediction, saying basically that the results are going to be discussed during the campaign. and then there was more of a split between our two senators. Angus King, who's an independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats. He talked about how this is just another typical day in the American justice system where 12 members of a jury heard the evidence and then they did their civic duty by rendering a decision. But then Republican Susan Collins, who was the last one to weigh in, she was more critical of the entire process. And her statement echoed some of the things we've heard from Republicans elsewhere and that your other guests had talked about. She suggested that that Trump was targeted because of who he was. She pointed out that the district attorney in this case had pledged to prosecute Trump. And then she said that, quote, the political underpinnings of this case further blur the lines between the judicial system and the electoral system. And then she said this verdict will likely be subject to protracted appeals, which I think everybody expects.
Mm. And Kevin, it's interesting, Senator Collins' response, because she has only recently announced that she will not be voting for Donald Trump.
Right. She has not been a supporter of Donald Trump in either of his campaigns. She didn't vote for him in 2016. 2020, she was more, you know, kind of mum about where she stood. But then she said that she won't support him. She supported others during the primary. And then I think voters will remember certainly that she was one of, I think it was 7 Republicans who voted to convict Donald Trump during his impeachment trial in the Senate. She got a lot of pushback from that, from Republicans here in Maine. But when it came to this trial, she has, you know, her comments again kind of echo more what we're seeing at the national level from other Republicans. She did not go nearly as far as some other Republicans, congressional Republicans, calling this, you know, echoing Trump's words about this being a witch hunt or that this was a rigged process. But, you know, she did raise concerns that this is kind of, like she said, blurring the lines between the judicial system and the electoral system.
Okay. And I want to turn to my political scientists there. And, you know, we hear this idea of blurring the lines. And I'm wondering if there is any evidence to support that. Is the fact that this the prosecutor is a Democrat enough to give that some credence, Mark?
In my opinion, no. I mean, I certainly think, obviously, you need to take the partisanship of a prosecutor who's elected into account and monitor that. But in the evidence that I've seen, there's nothing here to indicate that Bragg was acting as a partisan. And he certainly claimed that he is not. He's doing his duty as, you know, the Manhattan prosecutor. And he would have done the same for anyone who was accused of this, if the evidence indicated that he should. So Republicans would disagree with that, or many would, but I haven't seen any evidence that this is a partisan affair. And certainly I haven't seen any evidence whatsoever that this is being directed by President Biden or his Justice Department, which is a very common claim of Trump and many of his supporters.
Mm. And Kevin, I'll turn back to you before we say goodbye. Are you hearing from any of those who you speak with regularly in the legislature and either political party about, you know, an interesting reaction to this that has made you think maybe a little differently about what this verdict may mean to the presidential race?
Well, I'd say that a lot of the reactions we've gotten so far, again, do follow along the partisan lines. The two Republicans who are running against Representative Golden, or hoping to run against Representative Golden, they went farther than Collins did. They kind of questioned the fairness of this process. I think one thing I'll add is, you know, this is not just politicians and elected officials who are making these comments. When I've been out talking to voters as part of coverage of the second district Republican race, I heard this from voters. I heard voters, you know, Republican voters, who were saying, you know, this is a sham. This is a witch hunt. This is all Biden directing this. So it's, you know, whether that message is resonating with them or they firmly believe it, there certainly is a segment of Republican voters out there who honestly believe that this was an unfair process and that Biden's only going after Trump because of the presidential race.
Kevin, thanks so much for taking some time. Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent. On the line with us now, Colby College professor of government, Dan Shea, and he is the co-author of a new book, The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. Dan, thanks so much for calling in. You just heard Kevin Miller talking about the second district, and I'm wondering what your reaction to the verdict was, and how did you think about it in terms of the work that you've been doing about the rural voter?
Well, thanks for having me on. You know, may we live in fascinating, interesting times, and gosh, we sure do. So in terms of our work, the reaction is, to be honest, rather consistent with what we would imagine. You see, it's interesting. So Donald Trump, on the one hand, is probably the most cosmopolitan, non-urban presidential candidate we've ever had, right? He is not just from New York. He's from Manhattan. He's from a very densely populated part of the country, and he's very proud of that. At the same time, he is the darling of most rural voters. His numbers, his percentage in rural America was astronomical. It's a really important change. Well, why is that true? Well, it's because, I guess, you know, most would agree that he is perceived as the type of person that can bust up the lock that coastal elites have on politics, on government, shake the system, break things up, and return things to a different way of life, to make America great again. So as this all comes down yesterday, it seemed rather consistent that they would push against the institutions that they think are already against them, and as coastal elites and as Democrats in the city and Manhattan and so forth and so on. So it is consistent. It's unfortunate, though, that it seems to me that there is this skepticism about these institutions. They're seeing that in, not just in the courts, but throughout America, including the media, of course, John.
And Dan, let me ask you this. I know that you've done a lot of research on campaign management. Do you think this verdict will change how the campaigns are run or the message that they try to send going forward?
Yeah, well, it used to be that campaigns were a mix of persuasion and mobilization. I'd get voters to come to your side and get them to turn out. Well, I think most voters have taken sides already, right? So the trick now is mobilization. So the question is, will this mobilize either side? On the one hand, it seems like the Trump supporters are going to be very animated, very angered by this. But, of course, they can only vote once. Will it turn out a higher number of Trump supporters than we might have seen? Maybe. I think it's going to help fill some coffers, right? There's another way that to mobilize by sending in checks and so forth. The question that everybody's trying to figure out, it seems to me, is whether or not it'll also have a mobilizing effect on the left. It's uncertain. The one thing I will say is that, a month or two or five can be a lifetime in politics. Will voters still be thinking about this in September? Hard to say.
Well, Dan, I so appreciate you taking time, and we're going to have you back to talk more about your new book, The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. That's Dan Shea, professor of government at Colby College. I'm going to go to a couple emails that have come in here. Let's see. One is worried about the safety of the jurors. Chris asks, one of my first thoughts after I heard the verdict yesterday was the protection and safety of the jury. After what happened to Nancy Pelosi's husband and the violence of the January 6th mob, are there safeguards in place for these brave 12 jurors? I know, Pavel, that you are not in New York, but I did hear that those who have the names are both the prosecutor and the defense attorney and the defendant himself, Donald Trump. So when you hear that, what are your thoughts about how to best protect those jurors and whether indeed their lives could be in danger?
So I think that it is not unreasonable in the current political discourse to expect that there's going to be some level of threats if those names get out. I think that it is critical that the individuals that have those names protect them and that the courts use all means at their disposal to prevent those names from getting out. And certainly if those names did get out and somebody was found to have leaked them, those jurors would likely have a cause of action against that person and could have that individual could face a significant recovery. But the truth is, there's no standard mechanism to use. When you have such an unusual case with such unusual circumstances, however, the courts and certainly the government at large may find other resources, just police details, to be able to help these folks out if it really does get bad. But there is no standard operating procedure here.
Ron.
Yeah, I was thinking back to the aftermath of the 2020 election, where the Trump administration put a lot of pressure on various Republican officials, expecting them to cooperate in their attempt to, for example, create alternate slates of electors or to quote unquote, find the votes that Trump needed for victory, that sort of thing. And that a fair number of elected officials remained faithful to their constitutional obligations and to their office. And the former president has more or less promised to try to find people who won't do that next time. A democratic system relies upon the idea that people are going to have that sort of commitment to the process and the institutions and to the Constitution. And so I'm also concerned about the safety of the jurors, but I'm also concerned about future juries and our ability to rely on people to feel like this is an obligation that can be asked of them and that they should want to take seriously. We're already facing problems with people who are worried about serving on election days, for example.
Let's see. I'm going to go to another question here. This is an email from Patty. Patty writes, Trump, despite conviction, may be able to vote for himself if he's not in prison. This explains that in Florida, where Trump's residence, it defers to the state in which the conviction is determined. Because New York allows felons to vote, he may indeed be able to vote in Florida. So I guess Patty's point is that it's unclear, that the commentator we heard on the BBC may have been speaking a little too quickly. Mark, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert in Florida election law. I actually know a fair amount about New York state election law. I lived there for a number of years. In New York, Trump would be able to vote for himself. And I have heard that Florida does defer for felony voting issues to the state that the conviction took place in. If that's true, he should be able to vote for himself in November. If Florida didn't defer, my understanding is that he could then appeal to Ron DeSantis to be allowed to vote, which would be an interesting twist, I think.
That would be an interesting twist. Ron Schmidt, you're grinning. let's see. It's just another way in which this is sort of uncharted territory, right? I mean, Pavel, I'm wondering what you're going to be looking at going forward in terms of, as this case goes through the appellate courts, if it does, what is it that lawyers are looking for, want to learn from this case?
Yeah, so I think there are two really interesting issues that are going to be raised on appeal. One is kind of a more standard issue that we see in a lot of cases, but is interesting in this context, and that's the testimony of Ms. Daniels. You know, her testimony covered a lot of things. Some would argue that she exceeded the bounds of relevance, and certainly the defense felt it was enough to move for a mistrial. Whether or not the judge should have granted that mistrial is something that the former president's attorneys are going to argue extensively on appeal. The other thing I think folks are going to look at is what degree of specificity did the prosecution have to prove the crimes with? So under this statute, New York Public Law 175.10, it is a felony if the president falsifies business records in order to either aid in the commission of a crime or to cover up the commission of a crime. Now, the prosecution did not prove a specific other crime. They left it up to the jury. Typically in these types of cases, this isn't as much of an issue, because what you would see and what you would what the prosecutor would do is that they would charge that second crime along with the defrauding case. Here that didn't happen, and prosecutors didn't have a consistent theory on what crime the president was looking to either cover up or to commit, and left it up to the jury. I think that's going to be something that we're going to hear a lot of argument about on appeal, And it's something that is going to help define this law moving forward.
What are your thoughts? What was your reaction? What are your questions about the verdict yesterday in the Trump trial? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or find us on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we are talking about the verdict, the big verdict yesterday afternoon in which former President Donald Trump was found guilty in a New York courtroom of 34 felony counts. The trial was referred to as the hush money case. What is your reaction? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram. Our guest for this hour, Mark Brewer, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, and Pavel Binchek, who is a shareholder at Bernstein Scher with a background in criminal law in the military and federal state courts. We're going to go to Mike, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I mean, I was glad and all to hear the verdict, but honestly, in this environment right now, it strikes me as just one act in a long tragedy. And I've been hearing this, well, we've never seen this before, it's uncharted territory. Well, you know, if you read history about every empire in the past, yes, we have. And when an empire starts to crumble, it's very common for them to go to a corrupt dictator-type strongman. And that's what we did, and I'm afraid that's what we might do again. However this shakes out, my own personal prediction is that he's either going to win it or he's going to take it, and he will never do a day in jail.
Mike, thanks for your call. Ron, you are a student of political history. What do you have to say to Ron's to Mike's assessment that, well, you know, maybe the details are new, but overall, this is not new.
It's very difficult. I try to avoid making predictions, but it is important to notice long-term trends and patterns. And certainly, a lot of the centerpieces of Donald Trump's political career are ones that have been with us for a long time. You know, the emphasis on exclusion, the emphasis on the threats of deportation, the emphasis on race, those are a long-standing part of our political background here in Maine, as anywhere in the country. And it's important that we don't try to put all of this simply around the figure of Donald Trump.
And let me ask you, Mark Brewer, and we're going to talk about, this is going to tie together what Mike just asked and what Ron said at the beginning. I mean, Mike is saying this is a sign that a civilization is on the downturn. And Ron is talking about being worried about Donald Trump attacking our institutions. Do you tie those two together?
I certainly think the latter is an incredibly important part that we should be paying attention to here. I mean, Donald Trump has consistently, from the day that in November of 2015, when he declared his candidacy for the Republican nomination, he has consistently attacked the legitimacy of American public office holders and the very legitimacy of the American political system. And he's, if anything, he's ramped up those attacks throughout his trial in New York City. And I think what he's created is a very large segment of the American public that agrees with him on this and is completely willing to discount anything and everything unless it comes out of the mouth of Donald Trump. And that, in my view, is essentially unprecedented in American political history. I can't think of a comp for that. And so to me, that's the biggest danger around the figure of Donald Trump and the biggest thing that we need to be concerned about. And again, you know, you can love him or hate him, but when one person has that large of a potential impact on that large of a number of Americans, it's got to be concerning.
Mike, thanks for your call. Pavel, I want to ask you sort of a general legal question. Of course, you can't speculate on what's going to happen, but a lot of people seem to think that there's a really high likelihood that Donald Trump will receive probation, in large part because he does not have a criminal record. If he were to be on probation, what does that mean for the campaign? What does that mean for the presidential election?
So I think however it shakes out, and look, I don't have a crystal ball, right? Everybody knows that. There's a judge up there that's going to have a lot of discretion in terms of what kind of sentence he feels is appropriate. But I think it's very reasonable to consider that Donald Trump's ability to campaign in person in the way that he has in the past few election cycles is going to be limited. I think that there are going to be restrictions on his travel and his ability to move from place to place that are going to make it more difficult for him to run the type of campaign that he'd like to run. In general, probation takes many forms and many flavors depending on the needs of the particular defendant. But you will usually see movement restrictions. You will usually see restrictions on being able to leave a state, being able to travel freely, wearing things like ankle monitors so that your location is known at all times. It is not crazy to think that there are going to be some restrictions on the president. And it's important to think about what are some of the things the judge is going to be looking at when he's coming at a sentence. So typically, in a case where you don't have sentencing guidelines like this case, the judge has wide discretion in terms of what they think is an appropriate sentence. And that's why they're a judge. There's somebody who has been picked to have that background, have that ability, that gravitas to make these difficult decisions. But they're going to look at remorse. They're going to look at acceptance of responsibility. They're going to look at, yes, the individual's criminal background, their character. There's this totality of factors and circumstances that a judge can look at. And so while the former president doesn't have a criminal history, I do think there are things that are going to reflect poorly on him from this trial. For example, his violations of the judge's gag order that are going to impact his sentence. And so I don't think it's so easy to say, so easy to predict what's going to happen. It may not be as light as people think it is.
An email here from Kathy, and I'm going to go back to you, Pavel, because you've covered, worked in the military courts. This person writes, "Hi, I am a retired military veteran. I served in Iraq. My question, and I may have missed this, but you didn't. If Trump is now a convicted felon, he is unable to get a security clearance, correct? Then how can he be the commander-in-chief of our military?"
Yeah, so first off, Kathy, thank you for your service. But certainly, the rules for receiving clearances for people at that level are going to be very different for the rules that apply to you and I. The president, the bottom line is the president is going to get access to the information that he needs. The administrative state will find a way to get him that access. I think that's just reasonable to expect. If Donald Trump were looking for a job with a defense contractor, he probably would not qualify after this conviction.
We're going to get a call. We'll go to Bob calling from Saco. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. When I was paying attention to the trial, it really seemed that they were painting the atmosphere as far as the Billy Bush tape, as far as they didn't want this new information coming out right before Election Day. And they were painting that picture so they could know that it was a campaign election law violation. Could you guys speak to what that law is and explain it to us so we know more about what they were trying to paint the atmosphere for?
I'm going to turn back to you, Pavel.
Yeah, so the background here is that several individuals, including Michael Cohen, were convicted on federal campaign finance violations. Typically, when you run a campaign, you have to disclose all of your sources of money and what you spend that money on. The idea is that the disclosures that the Trump campaign made, even though Trump has never been charged himself, were fraudulent and not accurate. And so that is one of the laws that the New York Attorney General alleges that Trump was conspiring to break when he signed off on his own fraudulent business records. So that I think is how those two things tie together.
Okay. Bob, also,
yeah, go ahead, Ron.
It's my understanding that he that in addition to proving that there was an intent by Trump to commit fraud, to prove that he was intending to commit fraud in order to commit another crime. And the other crime was to have an effect on the outcome of an election, in specifically in the way that that election interference laws is written in New York.
Well, I think this is part of what makes this case challenging, right? Is that the prosecutors never presented a specific theory. They presented a lot of evidence that the jurors could interpret different ways. And they obviously, it seems from the verdict like they did interpret it that way. But I think this is going to be the big discussion on appeal, mm-hmm. and is going to be what decides whether or not this conviction stands.
An email here from Dan. All these complaints that the justice system has been politicized against Trump are just a joke. Trump has pledged to weaponize the justice system against his enemies if he's elected. But I don't hear any complaints from his supporters about that. Mark, I'm going to turn to you. And just this whole way we talk about the justice system has changed so much in the last few years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that it would have been unthinkable before Trump for people to be concerned that the Justice Department was being used as a political cudgel by a president. Although we do have some evidence of that. There's some evidence that Nixon did that when he was president, but that's, you know, people that weren't terribly cognizant of that, but not only has Trump kind of hinted at that, he's been explicit that if he's elected for a second term, he is going to do just that. And it plays into the ground that he's been tilling with his supporters, that he's being unfairly treated. And since this is happening to him, retribution by him is going to be more than justified. And an overwhelming majority of his supporters believe that.
All right. We're going to go to one more call. We'll go to Ralph, who's calling from Belgrade. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. The United States is more divided than it was pre-1864 with Abraham Lincoln. The Republicans are the new Confederates. They have the Second Amendment, and they all can have hunting rifles, but the government has a nuclear submarine and many battle tanks. The revolution won't take long, believe me.
Ron, Ralph is reflecting, I think, a fear many people have, that this is the beginning of something much more violent and much more scary.
I mean, there is a lot of concern about this, and that's not helped by the fact that that the former president spends a lot of time engaging in violent rhetoric. Mark mentioned Richard Nixon. I think one of the differences I've noted between the way that the president's supporters react to Donald Trump as opposed to the way they did to Richard Nixon is that as president and after, Donald Trump has always publicly evinced a lot of contempt for the American political and legal system. And Richard Nixon at least tried to convey this sense of being genuinely invested in American government and the American state, and as well as law and order. And the fact that Trump has not done that has created a different kind of set of pressures that are very worrying.
Pavel, does it make your job harder?
So I think that there are challenges now that we've had. But look, I've got to say, I'm an optimist, right? So I'm an immigrant. I'm a military veteran. I believe really, really, really deeply in the American experiment and the resilience of our system of government, even when it's strained. I mean, we survived the U.S. Civil War, the greatest, bloodiest battle conflict ever fought in the Western Hemisphere. And we're still here, right? We survived the 60s. We survived the rights riots of 1968, 1969, and we're still here. And so we, you know, the tide comes in and the tide goes out. But at the end of the day, our country is resilient and strong. We can still find ways to work together with people we disagree with. Maybe there are certain people on the extremes that don't get there, but I believe and I've seen that the majority of people do not fall into that camp. So I'm just not there with my colleagues on that. That having been said, in terms of the integrity of the courts and the politicization of the legal system, I think it's important to remember that there has always been some political element to the legal system. So there are things that district attorneys, for example, who's an elected official, just inherently have discretion on that we choose as voters, right? So they have discretion about who to investigate. They can prioritize certain types of crimes over others. What they don't have discretion on is what that jury comes back with a verdict. So while they can choose what to investigate, at the end of the day, somebody has to have committed a crime just like the rest of us to have been convicted. So, on the whole, I think that system is still working, even if we don't always agree with the political priorities of where the DAs choose to investigate.
Mark Brewer, I'm going to end with asking you a quick yes or no question. Does the next generation of political science professors who's teaching our grandkids see this as a pivotal moment in American democracy?
My guess is the answer to that is yes.
Well, thank you all for being with us today. That was Mark Brewer from the University of Maine, chair of the poli-sci department there, and Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. Pavel Binchak is a shareholder at Bernstein Scher with a background in criminal law, the military, and federal and state courts. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn, and our theme music was composed by Mike Gendro. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.